This podcast is brought to you by the Village of Bedford Park, your home for business. Over 450 businesses strong and growing with a safe, reliable Lake Michigan water supply. Visit VOBPbiz.com and bring your business home to the Village of Bedford Park.
Now, the WBBM Noon Business Hour.
WBM News Time, 12:03. Welcome to the Thursday, December 12th, 2019 edition of the WBBM Noon Business Hour. Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. The markets are up because of the latest tweet from President Trump regarding the progress in the U.S.-China trade talks. We're joined now by Paul Christopher, who is the head of global market strategy for the Wells Fargo Investment Institute in St. Louis. Paul, welcome back to the program. Progress in the U.S.-China trade negotiations would obviously be a good thing for the markets and for the economy as a whole. But you start to feel a little bit like Bill Murray waking up on Groundhog Day and hearing Sonny and Cher once again, because the rhetoric regarding the progress in this latest U.S.-China trade negotiation seems to mirror the rhetoric we've heard an awful lot of times before.
Yeah, that's right, Rob. It's just not it's not something you want to trade on right now. We were hearing just last week from the president that he would be content, he said in a tweet, to wait until after the 2020 elections to come to a deal with the Chinese. So it's not really very consistent. Moreover, we've heard so many times since January that we're close on a deal, that the Chinese are going to buy more from us, and then we come out a few days later and hear that, well, we're still negotiating with the Chinese on how much they're going to buy from us. Well, that should be the easiest part of this deal. If they can't agree on that, it tells me that they're having trouble with the tougher parts of this deal.
And they have delayed the tariffs, which would at least indicate maybe a sign of good faith or a sign of progress. Or was that something that was going to happen regardless?
We think it was likely that they were going to hold back on the December 15 tariffs, but they wanted to wait until the last minute maybe to sort of hold the sword of Damocles over the heads of the negotiators from the Chinese side. It always helps to have a little bit more leverage, and that's probably what the administration intended. Those tariffs, though, being suspended, could of course come back.
And the president did hint that he could wait them out past the election, wait the Chinese out past the election, which does seem to take away one potential piece of leverage the Chinese might have had, is that the leadership structure in Beijing will definitely be there after November 2020, and the leadership structure in Washington could have some very different people starting in January of 2021. And it seems like either that's posturing or maybe he really is just content to let this thing rip past Election Day.
Well, he may be, but for the leaders in China, it might be worth reminding them to be careful what you wish for, since many of the Democrats also take the same hard line or want to take the same hard line on China going forward. If one of them is elected president, that person, whoever it may be, may not want to use tariffs for leverage the same way the president did. But Chinese leaders would maybe have to get used to a different negotiating style and a different set of tactics. But the terms would probably still be very close to what Mr. Trump is offering now.
All right, Paul, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Paul Christopher, the head of global market strategy at the Wells Fargo Investment Institute in St. Louis. WBBM News Time, 12:09.
The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
If you're thinking about buying a house the coming year, could be a good time to do it. Interest rates may be in your favor. We're talking with Rick Sharga, who is the CEO of the C.J. Patrick Company in Orange County, California. Rick, welcome back to the program. What are just some of the factors that are lining up in favor of new home buyers in 2020?
Well, there's three things that are really lining up in favor. You mentioned the most important one probably, which is that mortgage rates continue to be at almost historically low levels. That makes a lot of properties much more affordable for the average home buyer. The second thing is that wage growth has actually begun to outpace home price appreciation, which hadn't been the case for quite some time. Homes have been getting expensive at a much faster pace than most people were seeing wages increase. And the third thing is we're finally starting to see the home builders wake up after a long hibernation. So we should have a little bit more supply available for home buyers in 2020 than we've had in recent years.
And where, I mean, so you talk about the new new home starts or the home builders have finally picked up. I mean, that was one of the areas of stagnation not too long ago, was that the home builders like basically couldn't keep up with demand.
And that's really still the case. The housing start numbers, which indicate that construction is planned in the near future, have started to pick up over the last few months. Still not back to where it was, certainly during the last housing boom, but even where we've been normally on historic levels. But we are starting to see the builders get more actively engaged. And they tend to be following population trends. So if you're in the Chicagoland area, which has actually seen a little bit of population decrease over the last couple of years, probably not going to be quite as much home building there as in some areas where you're seeing more people moving in.
10 years ago, when the Great Recession caused that housing boom to go bust, or maybe it's the other way around, you saw a lot of housing developments or construction projects that were basically stopped in their tracks. I mean, you're talking about building in downtown Chicago, where the skeleton was just left there by the construction crew because they ran out of money. If you flew into Las Vegas, you would fly over a lot of subdivisions that were just left idle. Have those projects been completed?
A lot of the projects were completed. Some, sadly enough, were actually bulldozed over. And there was an overbuilding epidemic during that housing boom that you're talking about. Houses were being built in places where people really didn't want to live, and there was just an anticipation that buyers would go further and further from, you know, central metropolitan areas and buy properties. So a lot of those have been completed. The builders really shut down for a while because in many cases they were competing with their own inventory that had been built a year prior, and there just wasn't a market for new home construction. It's taken a long time for them to get out of the doldrums. And we're really only starting to see signs of life for the first time in really about 10 years.
Now, when we're talking about new construction, are these existing homes that are torn down and that a new house is built on the land? Or are we going back to what you talked about, where a real estate developer buys up somebody's farm field, then builds 20 or 30 houses on it?
The latter is more the case. If a property is torn down and a new one built up, that really doesn't count as new home construction in the data that's collected. So you're really looking at builders either buying large areas of land like you suggested, or even smaller plots of land and building new homes there. Unfortunately, not a lot of the building is being done for first-time home buyers because it's really expensive right now to build a house. According to Fannie Mae, on average, it costs a builder about $80,000 before they even break ground because of all the regulatory hurdles they need to go through in most local markets. And if your starting cost is $80,000, really hard to build a terribly affordable house and still make money on it as a builder.
Well, thanks for the insights this afternoon. Rick Sharga, the CEO of the C.J. Patrick Company in Orange County, California. Coming up, we'll talk about the delicate challenge of buying holiday gifts for coworkers. How can you do it without stepping on toes? That's coming up next.
Money Talks, as the WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's not so easy deciding who should get a holiday gift at the office or what to get them. Joining us with some ideas now is Tom Gimbel, founder and CEO of the LaSalle Network here in Chicago. Tom, before we begin, on a percentage basis, is there any research that says a number of people actually do, how many workers actually give each other gifts during the holiday season?
Well, I haven't seen an actual list that shows a number or a percentage, but what I will tell you is my guess of people who give at least one gift is probably very close to 100%.
I mean, just, you know, someone who may be your work friend out of the office and that you give them a gift during a gathering off-site. But according to a LinkedIn survey, they found that 31% of employees feel they have to add coworkers to their gift-giving lists, and 40% wish their company would say that gift-giving is off-limits. So it definitely sounds like an interpersonal and emotional landmine or minefield to try to navigate between now and December 25th.
Well, I think that my independent research says that the same people who say they want the company to forbid it also don't want to go to the holiday party, the company picnic, or a happy hour. And sometimes we've got a little bit of too much bah humbug. And you don't need the company to forbid a gift. If you don't want to, no one has ever gotten fired for not giving a gift. And really, no one's ever gotten promoted, for the most part, for giving a gift. If you have a strong affinity to somebody that you work with, and you want to get them a gift, it's more than appropriate to do it. And if you don't want to give gifts, then don't. The problem becomes if you work in a team and there's eight people in your group and you give one to four of them and you don't give something to the other four, do people start to feel left out? And now you've got a game of emotions. But it's no different than roommates and if you're out of college and living with people, or aunts and uncles. And, you know, there's always going to be somebody that's upset.
And there are some gifts that one coworker that could to the other that could actually be deemed inappropriate.
Yeah, I think you probably want to stay away from giving something that has that you might find to be a funny joke, that may be a little bit risque, something that may be a little bit too personal. But if you really need to know what your relationship level is with somebody, and it comes down to an EQ monitor, your emotional intelligence. Do you really know where you stand with somebody and what lines you can cross or come darn close to crossing with?
And then what about buying a gift for the boss? Even if you like that person, is that recommended or no?
Again, I hate to default on the wishy-washy. It depends on the situation. But if you've been working with your boss for years, it really does make sense that you've got a good relationship, assuming that the boss gives you something as well, if it's that type of relationship. And if you are, I've seen it where people, if somebody's a baker, an easy way out is a lot of people will bake stuff and they'll bring in wrapped packages of cakes or cookies or what have you for people or bosses around the office, or they do a bottle of booze or things like that. But for somebody who's been working someplace for 3 months and they walk up with $150 bottle of wine for their boss, it's a little over the top.
Okay, well, you mentioned the one thing that actually is going to happen, at least at the radio station, in my experience over the past four Christmases here, is that this place is going to be awash in surplus baked goods from Christmas dinners and holiday parties. That's definitely going to be the norm here. And if diet plans are chucked out the window. Tom Gimbel, founder and CEO of the LaSalle Network, thank you for joining us this afternoon of the
Happy
Noon Business
holidays.
Hour. Coming up, we'll check the markets and later a growing question, what to do with the social media accounts of the dearly departed. That's the topic of Technology Thursday.
This is Chicago's all news station, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
Good afternoon. I'm Rob Hart. These are the top stories on News Radio WBBM. The markets are higher right now. Ahead, we'll take a look at what's moving Wall Street today. When you die, what happens to your social media accounts and more? And more importantly, what should happen? We'll talk about it in Technology Thursday. And later, the secrets in your wallet that could save you hundreds of dollars a year. News we're following. The debate is underway over the articles of impeachment leveled against President Trump, whether to send the matter to the full U.S. House. WBBM Market Watch. Markets are in positive territory. The Dow is up 140 points. The NASDAQ is up 37. The S&P 500 is up 19. AccuWeather says mostly cloudy today, windy and milder, and a high of 44. Right now we have 40 degrees in Chicago. WBBM News Time 12:31. The Noon Business Hour continues, presented by the Village of Bedford Park. The markets have been in positive territory all day long. Let's take a look with Mike Strich, Chief Investment Officer and National Head of Investments at BMO Wealth Management here in Chicago. Michael, welcome back to the program. Your assessment on where we are in the U.S.-China trade talks and if the markets are actually responding to something substantial.
Well, thanks, Rob. It's great to be back, and happy holidays to everyone. So, you know, let me just start by saying our baseline position is that the president is aware that it is politically rewarding to be tough on China. The U.S. population supports a tough stance on China, but that probably only goes to a point, and that point is when it starts to, you know, materially adversely impact the economy. I think we started to see that in the earlier fall of 2019, and since then,
we've kind of seen a reluctance to escalate the tensions further. And here we are today with this news of we're very close to a big deal. You know, our sense is that, again, the baseline is that we wouldn't think the president would want to escalate further. But I would say today's news, where there's this whisper of maybe a cut of existing tariffs of up to 50%, that would be a significant event if it were to transpire. But again, these things have come and gone, these news cycles. So we'll see. Base case, though, we don't think any further escalation, material escalation, is in the best interest of the president with the election only 11 months away.
Well, beyond that, some of the other gains for the Dow are being driven by positive growth at Caterpillar and Cisco. Let's start with Caterpillar, because it's an Illinois-based company. And once again, you know, big, heavy machinery that is sometimes seen as a bellwether of economic activity. Why did shares of Caterpillar jump?
Well, I think Caterpillar is also a proxy for global growth in an aggregate sense. And, you know, they had some sales news that came out over the last 24 hours that was not exceptional, but not bad either. I think it was basically flat sales growth over the last year-over-year period for the last 3 months. But my sense is the move in Caterpillar today in particular is more related to this idea that if there is a chance for a larger deal between the U.S. and China, that bodes well for global growth heading into 2020. And companies such as China or other sort of industrial-related items, semiconductors as well, Cisco, Micron, companies like that, would also stand to benefit. So you're seeing kind of a knock-on effect in those industries and those names in particular.
As analysts try to grade out the impact of a U.S.-China trade deal on the markets and on the economy as a whole, do they have differing scenarios of what would be good, better, and best? Or is it just the mere presence of a deal would be a positive development?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there's certainly a lot of scenario analysis that we do. And it's kind of weighted by the likelihood of an outcome. And that's where I go back to my earlier comment that, you know, a significant rollback in tariffs, I think most Wall Street analysts would say, was on the lower probability event side. So that would be an upside surprise. I think the consensus at this point, and it's a position that we've held all along, is that this is a situation that's going to be with us, this being, you know, tensions between the U.S. and China. It'll be with us for the foreseeable future, the next, you know, generation potentially even. And so anything that is in line with a steady state sort of, difficult relationship, I think, is the base case. Marginally worse is to be expected. Neutral is kind of just, I would say slightly better than where we are today. And if we did get a big move, as such as a 50% haircut, that would be very positively received. But in a general sense, I think people are expecting base case, which is just this sort of back and forth, tit for tat stuff that goes on into the foreseeable future.
And then very quickly, as everyone's talking about China, there is an election underway in Great Britain right now that could be is another referendum on Brexit. That storyline has kind of gone fallow in the last couple of weeks. What happens if Boris Johnson and the pro-Brexit forces, the Tories, maintain their majority in Parliament?
Well, that's a great question. This is a big day as it relates to a lot of geopolitical events around the world with the tariff news here, or the tweets this morning, and also the Brexit election, which has been on the back burner. I think the reason it's been on the back burner is sort of the view there is that we would get a conservative victory. We would get a deal that is then known. That's the Johnson plan. And then we'd have to get into the negotiation phase of how that actually comes to pass, which is another whole set of complexities that will be dealt with in the future. But if the Conservatives do win the majority outright, that sort of gives a runway to a previously understood outcome. Anything different than that is when we get into a more nervous situation, because then it becomes unclear which way things are going. And the worst case scenario would be a very mixed outcome that then puts potentially a no deal type of Brexit back on the table. But that's probably a low probability type of outcome.
Thanks for joining us. Mike Stritch, Chief Investment Officer and National Head of Investments at BMO Wealth Management, based in Chicago. Coming up, social media companies are facing the question of what to do with the accounts of people who died.
Information to make cash and save cash. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
It's Technology Thursday on the WBBM Noon Business Hour. Social media companies are grappling with the question of what to do with the accounts of people who passed away. Our guest is Paul Hochman, president of Humongous Media in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and former tech editor of the Today Show. Paul, welcome back to the program. We've all encountered this at one point in our lives now, in our digital lives, where you have a friend or a colleague who is a Facebook friend who has since passed away, and maybe their birthday or some sort of memory pops up on your timeline, and it may be actually a sad reminder of what has transpired and what has happened. If social media companies start knocking out those accounts of people who have died, you might be robbing people the opportunity to grieve.
That's exactly right. It's a very, very tough balance. It's a new balance, by the way, that we all have to strike, obviously, because, you know, Twitter and Facebook have not in sort of, you know, human terms have not been around that long. But what's happening almost immediately is exactly that balance between etiquette and thoughtfulness, you know, basically etiquette and technology. So in specifically, as you just said, say if a friend of yours, even if it's just a digital friend, Facebook or LinkedIn or other or Twitter friend, if someone passes away, if it's a relative, a colleague, as you said, well, if you get a notification that it's their birthday and, hey, please wish this person a happy birthday, that's an obvious jolt, right? Nobody wants that. And certainly, according to the folks at Facebook and Twitter and other social media folks, they don't want that either. On the other hand, the flip side is true, too. In a number of cases, I've gone through this actually recently. A friend of mine passed away too early, but his wife set up a foundation to raise funds for research in the disease that killed him. And that's something that everybody wants to keep alive, literally and figuratively. So that's the challenge that these folks are facing.
Now, Facebook has given users the opportunity to designate a friend who can take over their account after they die. And I have seen in some cases that page or that account be turned into a memorial account where you can remember them on their birthday or remember them during some big date in their life. And so that it doesn't just show up as the AI reminding you of somebody who's died, that can actually become a celebration of that person's life.
That's right. In fact, they call it a legacy contact, or at least Facebook does. And legacy contacts are people, and you should think about it, if you have a digital life, and a lot of us do, if you think about what happens after you pass away, you should think about it in the best advice I've seen is think about it exactly the same way as you think of a will. In other words, you want to take care of not only, you know, deciding who gets all that information, or in the case of a will, the resources, but also who's in charge and what are the rules. And believe it or not, you can actually put a whole bunch of your relatives' minds at ease if you take care of that and you designate someone to make those decisions after you die. And in Facebook, just for listeners who are interested, the settings on Facebook, you go to settings on Facebook, click memorialization settings, click edit, and then you have lots of options. And so to that point, yes, designating somebody who can make those choices for you is a very good way to take care of all those details when you're not around.
And even though this sounds like a downer or a macabre conversation to have, but at least in my own experience, two radio colleagues who've passed away, one recently, one several years ago, they did kind of turn over the reins of their Facebook account to a friend or a relative, and they updated people about the funeral service, about a wake, about a visitation, about where they could have a party to celebrate this person's life. And people appreciated it. It kept them in the loop.
That's exactly right. Look, these accounts, all the social media has been set up, at least initially, for sure, was to keep people connected. And to your point, it is not macabre or dark exclusively. Of course, it's sad. But to your point, people who stay connected after a person who they all love or respected passes away are actually feeling better about that. So to the extent that you can, if you're making it possible for at least someone, say a legacy contact in Facebook's case, to take care of that, you've actually helped a lot of people. It is sad, but it's a good way to think of their feelings as well.
And very quickly, Paul, before I let you go, chances are these sociological and ethics questions that we're grappling with this afternoon, chances are Mark Zuckerberg didn't think about them when he was making the Facebook at Harvard 16 years ago.
No, my guess is, based on what I've read, that probably wasn't foremost in his mind, but I will make no more editorial comments after that one.
All right. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. Paul Hochman, president of Humongous Media, former tech editor of The Today Show, based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Join us this time tomorrow for Entrepreneur Friday, and still to come, money hacks, savings that could be in your wallet right now.
Making sense of your dollars. The WBBM Noon Business Hour continues.
At this very moment, you could literally be sitting on secrets that could save you hundreds of dollars a year. We're talking about money hacks in your wallet. Our guest is Ted Rossman, industry analyst at creditcards.com, based in New York. Ted, welcome back to the program. Before we move on to some of the perks that you may not know you have with your credit cards, let's talk about some of the savings apps that could be available to you that could help you go through your expenses and find places where you can squirrel some money away.
Yeah, I think a great tip along those lines for holiday shopping is to do all of your online shopping through a portal. So it could be a generic site like Rakuten, or it could be a credit card specific site such as Chase Ultimate Rewards. Or yet another example is a lot of airlines and hotels offer these, like American Airlines comes to mind. In all of these examples, you're going to click through the rewards site offered by any of those programs I mentioned or others, and then go to Macy's or Nordstrom or wherever you're buying something from. Just that referral step could give you 5% extra cash back, or sometimes even more.
And then what about some of the credit card rewards or perks that people may not know they have?
There are a lot of good perks. Some notable ones include extended warranties. Most Citi cards will tack 2 years onto the existing warranty if you pay with that card. That could be a tremendous savings. Picture like appliances and electronics and things like that. There's also purchase protection perks. This is going to defend you against any sort of breakdown or loss or theft, usually within 90 to 120 days of purchase. So if you use the right card, like the Chase Freedom or the Amex Blue Cash Everyday, this can protect you. I know somebody who broke a brand new Apple Watch just a few days after buying it, and she was able to get reimbursed through her credit card.
And then when it comes to benefits, are the vast majority of credit card perks still travel-based, or are there other perks that are taking a percentage of what rewards cards can give back?
They really run the gamut. They include travel as well as cash back, even some more intangible kind of things like cell phone insurance. If we're talking about travel, a good one to think about, especially around the holidays, is that if you have an airline credit card, typically that's going to come with a free checked bag. And oftentimes it's not just for you, but it's also for your traveling companions. So if you're a family of four that's flying this holiday season and you get this airline card that maybe has a $95 annual fee, you could save $120 each way on bag fees, because usually it's $30 a bag, and then you multiply it in this case by your four-person family.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Ted Rossman, industry analyst at creditcards.com, based in New York. If you missed any part of today's show, you can go to our stream and just rewind to the time you want. We have a pause and rewind function that works both online and by updating the radio.com app.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.